Well, it's good this morning to be back in Luke chapter 8, picking up where we paused for the Easter week. And if you remember back to where we were in chapter 8, we had just concluded that dramatic scene in which Jesus had calmed the storm, in which his disciples, filled with fear, seeing the boat taking on water, had pleaded with him to wake up. He had awoken and spoken a single word, and all of a sudden the waves and the wind had calmed themselves. We're in that section of Luke, chapter 8, in which the story has been wrestling with this theme of the identity of Jesus. How do we recognize who Jesus is? How do the people around Jesus recognize who he is? And in many ways, this has been one of the ongoing themes of Luke's gospel through these eight chapters. And we've seen very different answers to the question, who is Jesus? We've seen the role of humility in coming to recognize who he is, and we've also seen those who, without that humility, have struggled to recognize who Jesus is. We've seen his disciples bend a knee. We've seen his own family ready to throw him off a bluff. We've seen the religious teachers arguing with him about his interpretation of the law. But in this section of Luke's gospel, chapter 8 in particular, something else has been happening around this question of who is Jesus. Jesus' disciples, who seem to have recognized and understood who he was, suddenly find themselves seeing and experiencing something more of Jesus than they had expected. All of a sudden, we find ourselves in chapter 8 in some of the most dramatic scenes of Luke's entire gospel. A storm at sea that begins to intensify until Jesus' disciples are panicked and terrified. With one word, he calms the storm, and of course, the familiar line, "Who is this man that even the wind and the waves obey him?" Disciples who had not misidentified Jesus, they knew and understood who Jesus was, but yet as they followed him, they began to sense and experience more of who Jesus was. Maybe that's a good definition of what it is to follow Jesus, to realize who he is, but to be constantly realizing more who he is. To have something, but to constantly be receiving more of that thing at the same time. In one way or another, we are always coming to terms with more of who Jesus is. In our passage today, the disciples get another front row seat for experiencing that in perhaps an unexpected way. But this time, it'll be two new groups that we get to watch and see how they respond and recognize Jesus in the story. It will be a man possessed by demons, as they will describe it, a legion of them, an army of them, and a town who comes to see, having heard this news, and they themselves forced to contend with, who is Jesus, and what will we do with him? Again, as is becoming the pattern in Luke, their reactions are probably not what we would expect from the story. If you've got your Bibles, Luke chapter 8, it's interesting as well, I pointed this out when we were looking at the storm story, how short it is. If you look even in your Bible back up to verse 22, one little paragraph, this dramatic scene of the calming of the storm. But as we read today of this man healed of his demons, you'll notice the story gives us much more detail, probably because Luke is interested in this question. When people see the power of Jesus before them, how is it that they respond to this revelation of who he is? Luke chapter 8, beginning in verse 26. Then they sailed to the country of the Gerasenes, which is opposite Galilee. When Jesus had stepped out on land, there met him a man from the city who had demons. For a long time he had worn no clothes, and he had not lived in a house but among the tombs. When he saw Jesus, he cried out and fell down before him and said with a loud voice, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, do not torment me." For he had commanded the unclean spirit to come out of the man. For many a time it had seized him. He was kept under guard and bound with chains and shackles, but he would break the bonds and be driven by the demon into the desert. Jesus then asked him, "What is your name?" And he said, "Legion," for many demons had entered him. And they begged him not to command them to depart into the abyss. Now a large herd of pigs was feeding there on the hillside, and they begged him to let them enter these. So he gave them permission. Then the demons came out of the man and entered the pigs, and the herd rushed down the steep bank into the lake and drowned. When the herdsmen saw what had happened, they fled and told it in the city and in the country. Then people went out to see what had happened. And they came to Jesus and found the man from whom the demons had gone sitting at the feet of Jesus, clothed and in his right mind. And they were afraid. And those who had seen it told them how the demon-possessed man had been healed. Then all the people of the surrounding country of the Gerasenes asked him to depart from them, for they were seized with great fear. So he got into the boat and returned. The man from whom the demons had gone begged that he might be with him. But Jesus sent him away, saying, "Return to your home and declare how much God has done for you." And he went away, proclaiming throughout the whole city how much Jesus had done for him. Luke chapter 8. The story we're looking at this morning is directly connected to that storm story that we looked at a couple of weeks ago. You probably see that. The storm is brought to a calm, and in the very next verse, we read that the boat has now arrived where it had originally set out to go. Rescued from the storm, Jesus and his disciples in that boat reach the other side of the lake, the Sea of Galilee. They have come from the place that we're most familiar with in Jesus' story, that little scattered collection of Jewish towns and villages there on the west coast of the Sea of Galilee, amongst that region where Jesus had been raised, his home there in Nazareth, among those towns of Galilee. But now Jesus has, for the first time in this gospel, crossed the lake and landed on the east side into a region that was not characterized by Jewish towns or villages, but by the Gentiles who lived there. So much of Jesus' ministry had been there amongst his people, amongst the Jewish people, characterized by his teaching in their synagogues and arguing with Jewish leaders and debating about Jewish customs and laws. But as he reaches this other shore of Galilee, the region of the Gerasenes, he finds himself in an altogether different place. For Luke, it's no coincidence that the forces of opposition against him, this man with the demonic spirits, would approach him here as he steps onto this ground. I mentioned a couple of weeks ago when we looked at the storm story that for Jews and probably those disciples, this image of wild wind and waves wasn't just atmospheric. They would have seen it as a kind of chaos that the water represented, perhaps even the forces of darkness trying to sink Jesus' boat there where they were thought to rule and reign. And so it is in these two stories, Jesus leaves that little protection of Jewish synagogues and towns and teachers, and he finds himself now in this chaos of the sea and passing into the land of the Gentiles with their foreign gods. And no more than Jesus has stepped his foot, Luke says, out of the boat and onto the ground, than does one of these Gentile pagans, one of these men crowded with a legion of evil spirits, comes rushing to meet him. A king has arrived into new territory, and the royal envoy that comes to greet him are these demonic spirits in this man. The only one who seems to sense the significance of Jesus' arrival to that place are the spirits that compel this madman before him. But these demons come in the form of a human body, a man. And Luke stresses the description of the condition that this man is in. The man is no longer in the city, but he lives alone, lives amongst the tombs, among the dead, and he finds himself constantly without clothes, but instead like an animal, driven from place to place in the wilderness naked. The image we get is not really a human at all, but this kind of beast that comes upon him. This is what the demons have done to him. They've stripped him of any sense of human identity. They've robbed him of any profession, any meaning or belonging, a place. They've isolated him among the tombs and the dead. If there's an image of what human brokenness can be in its completest form, I want to offer you this man and the work that these demons have done upon him. There's something in him, something about this image of him, that is more than just his story, but the brokenness, the aim, the goal of what the enemy seeks to do to all. As we're reminded in scriptures, Satan comes to steal, to kill, and to destroy. And do we not see all of it here in this man, robbed of any possession, driven out of any community, turned no longer into a man, but into wildness itself? But Luke does not only give us the image of this man as he comes to Jesus. Luke also gives us this parenthetical, the ESV literally puts parentheses around it, but a kind of flashback to the history of this man within that land. Many times the people of the town had sought to restrain him on their own. They had put him in chains and shackles and posted a guard over him to try to keep him safe or under their protection, but each time the man would break free of the chains and again by these spirits be driven out into the desert and the wilderness. All of their power and efforts, all of it had been for nothing. Each time, all of their efforts to restrain him had only led to him once again breaking free back into that position the demons had driven him. The storm that Jesus faced a couple of weeks ago when we looked at it was a unique storm, but we talked about how it really represents so many of the storms that we all experience in life. I think something is also true of this man, a particular man in a particular place and time and situation. But there is something in him that is also true of the brokenness of the human experience. Satan still works all of his powers in this age towards the destruction of all things. It doesn't take much work. Open your eyes and look out your window. Pay attention as you're driving the streets, talking to people you know, to get that same sense of isolation and dehumanization, the madness that Satan still works even in our day. And surely you can also recognize the same limits of our human power to fix these problems, the chains and shackles and guards and programs and systems that we still depend on to try to solve humanity's problem. And what do we find? We find them over and over broken and the same brokenness spreading. It is, as Paul says in Romans, that all creation seems to be groaning in anguish and anticipation for a day of redemption when all things will be transformed. What Paul's recognizing is that we live in a moment when such things are not yet transformed, but are still groaning in anguish and anticipation. How will these things be fixed? How will the brokenness of humanity actually be solved? If you don't feel something of that desperateness, the desperateness of how often our own plans and schemes and programs and laws fail to do the things we want them to do, then perhaps you haven't spent enough time looking around the world. What is humanity to do with all of its own inefficiencies to fix what is broken? The ways our best efforts are never quite enough to really do what needs to be done. But perhaps part of what is so powerful about this story is that Jesus does not neglect these places. Jesus has gone through the trouble of a storm at sea to step foot in this ground for what? He meets a man, heals the man, is rejected by the town, gets back in his boat, and crosses again to Galilee. Jesus has done this work for one man in one place, and yet the Son of the Most High God, as he's called here, is willing to take the trip to do it. It's interesting how this man approaches Jesus. There's not wrestling for power. There's not posturing for any advantage, the spiritual forces of darkness against him. There's no real spiritual battle at all, is there? The man runs and falls at Jesus' feet, and immediately the demons begin to beg and plead with Jesus not to be destroyed by him. Look at what they say. When we saw Jesus, he cried out and fell down. When he saw Jesus, he cried out and fell down before him and said with a loud voice, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you not to torment me." Reading it again this week, I couldn't help but think how Peter, when he encountered Jesus' power for the first time, do you remember the scene, the miraculous catch of fish that almost began to sink the boat? Peter coming to the realization that this was not just a teacher. And what does Peter do? Luke records it. But when Simon Peter saw it, he fell down at Jesus' knees saying, "Depart from me, for I am a sinful man, O Lord." Of course, Jesus would in that moment call Peter to follow him, to become a disciple. And so too, even as it is the spirits within this man that recognizes Jesus, Jesus will deliver him and call him to be a disciple. In Peter's case, Peter recognizes the power of Jesus. Here, it is the spirits of darkness that recognize the power of Jesus. But both of them know precisely who Jesus is as they see his work before them. both see Jesus' power and recognize what he possesses. The same power that will bring a disciple to the ground in humility is the same power that will leave these evil spirits begging to be spared from him. Jesus need not defeat them. They know they are defeated from the very moment of Jesus' arrival into their territory. As they attempt to negotiate some sort of diminished defeat, they find a nearby herd of pigs and request that Jesus will allow them to at least go from the man into these. Jesus asks their name, and the answer that comes back is legion. It's a way of saying that this is not one spirit or a few, but an army of spirits, a legion of spirits that are within him. Jesus has faced the raging winds and waves, and now he stands before an army of demonic forces. Now this demonic army decides not to fight, but pleads for some sort of negotiated surrender, just as the winds and the waves at one word return themselves to calm. I don't think it's coincidence that the pigs and the demons in this story end up drowning. Leaving the man and going into the animals immediately rush down the hillside into the water and are drowned. It's the very fate the disciples had just been afraid they would experience in the storm. Jesus delivers them and sees them through, but now it is the pigs and the spirits in them that submerge themselves into the chaos of the waters and find themselves drowned by it. Then we get a second response in the story to what is, if we were honest, a pretty dramatic scene to have witnessed if you were one of these Gentile herdsmen standing by and watching this all play out. The madman you had known perhaps your whole life, completely healed, and the pigs you had been responsible for, now drowned and wallowing in the water. And so what do these herdsmen do? They rush back to the town and begin to speak to everyone they can find about what they've just seen. A random man in a boat came across the sea, stepped foot, healed the madman you all know, and now our animals are in the water. So the people come to see for themselves, as you probably would as well. What they find is perhaps for them completely unexpected. The wild, unrestrained man that for all of their chains and guards they never could keep in one place now sits clothed in his right mind at the feet of Jesus. That image is important. It's one Luke's used before, and we're going to see him use it again. The man is seated in a position of a disciple. He's sitting, listening to a teacher teach. It's an image of humility, an image of discipleship, of wanting to learn and be changed by what Jesus is offering. Perhaps this is what Jesus does for all of his disciples. We fall before him like Peter, depart from me, I'm broken. Or even these spirits, do not torment me. But Jesus, by his power, lifts us and sits us at his feet, calls us in our brokenness to be disciples, and as we listen, he begins to teach us and guide us on what it means to follow him. There is in this man a kind of simplification and focus of his life. I don't know if you see that, but everything that's come before has been wild. He is an image of wildness, driven constantly from place to place, bound one day, then breaking free and out into the wilderness the next. He's this image of never quite coming to rest, never belonging to one place. But now we find him seated at Jesus' feet, learning. Peter walks away from his nets. Matthew abandons the complicated work of tax collecting. This man, no longer driven in every direction, constantly restless, but now sitting before Jesus, focused on Jesus, listening and following Jesus, this new purpose to his life. If you've ever read C.S. Lewis's book, Surprised by Hope, it's the story of his conversion. C.S. Lewis was a well-known atheist before he came to Christ, having spent time in the trenches of World War I and written quite extensively about his atheism. And as he began to come to a saving knowledge of Christ, there's a place in the book in which he begins a new kind of self-reflection, a kind of internal wrestling that he had not experienced before. He writes in that, "For the first time, I examined myself with a serious, practical purpose. And there I found what appalled me, a zoo of lusts, a bedlam of ambitions, a nursery of fears, a harem of fondled hatreds. My name was Legion," C.S. Lewis records. He picks up on the image of this wild man. Inside of me, all of this same restlessness, desires and the spirits of this age driving me constantly in tireless new pursuits. Again, you may not have legions of demons in you, but like the storm is perhaps all storms, and this man's brokenness is perhaps all brokenness, don't neglect the fact that there is a similar kind of war within your own soul. A battle, a legion of temptations, a complicated mess of your own motivations, a constant danger to be driven again out into the wilderness and isolation and brokenness. C.S. Lewis looked at his own interior life and said, "My name is Legion." And I think any honest human who looks at the chaos within their own life can't help but say there is more at work within me than the kind of simple focus of this disciple seated before Jesus. In humility, we bring all of these things to Christ. And he begins that work of simplifying and focusing our desires and our ambitions and our expectations, our sense of identity and purpose. To come to Christ as a disciple is to find him simplifying our perspective on all things as we sit at his feet, as we listen to what he teaches, and we begin for the first time to define ourselves not by ourselves, but by his calling. It really must have been a remarkable thing for the people of that town who had known this wild man for so long to now see him in this state and this condition. But isn't it interesting how the town responds? They hug him with excitement and celebration. They throw a party to welcome one of their own back to healing and health. They start clapping and worshiping this God, this power that's been able to do this miracle. No, they don't do any of those things in the story. Then all the people of the surrounding country of the Gerasenes ask him, this him is Jesus, ask Jesus to depart from them, for they were seized with great fear. So Jesus got into the boat and returned. They see this power of God before them to heal and restore, and they find themselves afraid, and they beg Jesus to leave them alone. What is it about this Gentile town that they have become more comfortable with the madness of demons and the destruction, brokenness of humanity around them than they are to the saving power of Jesus at work? What warning is this, that we can actually prefer the brokenness of sin over the healing of salvation? What does it mean that a town can want that brokenness and reject the healing that God is offering? If I could be honest with you, I don't know what all to make of this. When you see it, it becomes so shocking and hard to understand that we could spend all of our time and resources and energy binding and shackling and guarding and have that work by the power of God done for us and reject it, be afraid of it. In the story, is not everything backwards from what you would expect? The demons are the one who recognize Jesus' power. The madman is the one who ends up sitting still at Jesus' feet. And the respectable town hates it and pleads with Jesus, who has just done the thing they couldn't do. They ask him to leave. But there is in this insanity something sadly true that I think many of you, as I see you shaking your heads, recognize is true in our own day as well. This world rejects Jesus. Is this not what the very Beatitudes would tell us? Blessed are the poor. Blessed are those who mourn. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst. Blessed are those who are persecuted. For they will see what is before them, receive God and understand. Blessed are those who are not offended by him. For the world will be, in all of their riches and happiness and joy and self-pursuit. Does Jesus not, as the scriptures say in this story, expose the wisdom of the world for what it actually is, folly? The end of the story gives us yet still more surprises. We haven't got through all of them yet. The healed man, as I think everyone in the room could probably imagine, begs Jesus, "Can I go with you?" He knows these people all too well, and the last thing he wants now in his healing is to stay in this place, but to be with Jesus. Luke uses the same word here. The man begs or pleads with Jesus, as the demons who come and throw themselves before Jesus and beg not to be destroyed by him. Twice this man has pleaded with Jesus. First, the demons, now as a disciple, to be with him. But Jesus says no. Who amongst us would have expected that? Wouldn't this scene have been much better if the man had ridden on a beautiful sunny day back across the lake to the land of Jesus and his hometown and his people and been welcomed there by them? But Jesus says no. Return to your home, he says, and declare how much God has done for you. And the man went away, proclaiming throughout the whole city how much Jesus had done for him. Is this man not a true disciple? Obedient even when it's not his own desires? And the crowd may be able to convince Jesus to leave. But how ironic that they're now stuck with the same man they used to shackle and bind and guard, who now will not stop talking about Jesus, who they ask to leave. The demons want not to be destroyed, but destroy themselves. The man wants to go, but is called to stay. The town wants Jesus to leave, but they end up stuck with one of Jesus' earliest evangelists. And so it is, Jesus is Lord. What can you say that but Jesus' kingdom is coming, ruling and reigning? That Jesus commands the winds, the waves, the demonic forces, and his own disciples, and they obey. In the end, what I think this passage, what I think much of Luke chapter 8 is actually about, is fear. But not the fear that the people had of this wild man raging and roaming around in madness. The real question is this fear of the Lord. This is, remember, directly connected to the storm story, the sea story, as if Luke wants us to read these two together as one. It's this shifting fear of the world and the things in it, and the sudden realization that Jesus' power is far greater than those things, that in both stories produces unexpected fear. Perhaps there's something deep here that each of us is called to contend with, in realizing that we would prefer to live without fear of any kind, fear of the world, fear of God, but that there is a better fear given these two fears before us. We, I think, would like to live like the town people did, choosing the demon over Jesus, because at the end they had their own means and ways and mechanisms for dealing with that. It's interesting that all the demonic forces, a legion of them in one man, perhaps his suffering, all of those demons resting here on them, was somehow the town taking those things away from themselves and forcing them on this one man. Perhaps it is their constant comparison of themselves to him that not only torments him with these spirits, but blinds them in their pride to their own need. How easy would it be at any time to look at his madness and say, well, at least we're not like that guy. At least my brokenness and problems aren't like that guy's. Perhaps the demons could even be appeased. They could work out some negotiations. They seem to be negotiating with Jesus, after all. And they can always scapegoat this one man with all of the problems and difficulties and challenges they face. But there's none of that in coming to Jesus. None of that bargaining or negotiating or using or comparing. Even the demons bow before him. His disciples fall before them. Everyone who sees Jesus in his real power is undone. Any plan or scheme or idea or opinion seems to fall apart. And those who really see Jesus seem to have no desire but to hear and understand his word alone. Whatever this terrible situation between this man and that town, whatever their failed efforts to deal with it by chains and guards, the town must have felt some degree of control, if only in their fight, that felt better to them than the humility required to listen and receive Jesus. Let that be a word of warning for us as well, too. We can actually enjoy the fight, the complexity, the brokenness, the comparison, our own plans and ideas and schemes and the power we get from trying to fix things by our own initiative. We could prefer all of that brokenness over the actual power of God, which demands submission and humility. Because the power of God, the fear of God, it demands obedience. It demands humility. John, in his gospel, says it this way, and this is the judgment. The light has come into the world, And the people loved the darkness rather than the light, because their works were evil. This is hard to say, but many would take all of the world's brokenness, complain about it all day long, blame and scapegoat and compare and wallow in it, call themselves miserable by it, and all that would be better to them than actually bending a knee before Jesus and entrusting their life to him. And so it is, Proverbs tells us, in the fear of the Lord, one takes strong confidence, and his children will have a refuge. The fear of the Lord is a fountain to life, that one may turn away from the snares of death. There's not a lot of talk about fear of the Lord right now. Barry and I will often talk on the weekend about what I'm preaching and how I'm ending and how it'll impact the way we respond in worship. And we were both struggling to come up with a lot of fear of the Lord worship songs. We live in a time where people have a lot of opinions, a lot of arguments, a lot of plans and schemes, a lot of guards and chains, if I could use the image. I worry a lot of us have fallen more in love with fighting for God than we actually are with God. More afraid of what lies ahead than we are fearing the Lord and humble obedience to him. The image of Jesus in this story is that he steps onto the land and the demons come trembling and falling before him and begging for mercy. Who is this that speaks one word and the wind and the waves obey him? That with one word a legion of darkness flee from his presence? And what can you do when you see this power of God on display before you? But stop. Worship and be in awe. Be afraid of this power before you. Sit at his feet and listen to what he might say to you. 2 weeks ago, when we looked at those disciples caught in the storm at sea, do you remember their panic and their terror as the boat began to take on water? As Jesus awakes and calms the storm, do you remember their response? They were seized with great fear. Standing there in the boat with the water and wind now calm and flat, having seen the power of Jesus on display before them, a new kind of fear took hold. No longer that restless panic, that fear of chaos and brokenness and death, the fear of the storm or the madness of the dark legion, but the fear at what it is to be in the presence of one who commands those things with a word and they obey. Luke is telling us in chapter 8 that Jesus is not just a religious teacher. He's not just philosophical, religious ideas. He's not just advice that you can use to make your life and your plans go a little more smoothly. He's not just a miracle worker. He's not some bottled up power that you carry around and use when you get in a tough spot. Jesus is God. The same God that out of the chaos of the dark waters spoke and life emerged. The same God that calms wind and waves and storm. The same God that commands a legion of darkness to flee and they obey. And this same God by his Spirit calls you and says, follow me. Obey me. Become my disciple. If you don't in that moment have some sense of this fear that the gospel writers are speaking of, not the kind of fear that drives you into chaos and anxiety, but the kind of fear that all of a sudden focuses everything, that reorients everything, that reprioritizes everything in your life, that if this man has this power, what then does it mean for me and all things to come? Well, then Luke's question, who is Jesus? You haven't fully answered it. You haven't fully probed the depths of who he is before you. For to really see him is to be struck with this fear, this awe, this sense of meaning and new purpose, the coming to rest at his feet, the turning of all of your attention and identity to him. There is nothing this man cannot say or demand or ask that I would not do well to hear and to obey and to humble myself before. But what are we to do? The world has seen the light and they prefer the darkness. The world has seen his power and felt that fear and so driven him away that they might not be humbled by it anymore. And so the question comes to us, as it always does his disciples. The storm calmed, his identity revealed, a new fear in your heart. Will you follow? Will you listen? Will you turn all parts of your heart and life over to him? Or will you, like the town, say, I preferred things a little more under my own control as I had them before. I'll take the madness and the wild man over the power of this man, Jesus. It's no small thing to say you will humble yourself. It's no small thing to say I want to experience that fear of the Lord that leads to life. As the proverb says, a fountain of life. But this morning, in all humility, that's my request to the Lord, and I know yours as well. God, let us sense again your real power. Let us sense again that you rule and reign, that you are king over all things, that all things past and present and future are yours, and that I will not live in this world of fear and chaos and anxiety, but will trust all things coming to sit and rest again at your feet, putting my identity and my hope and my future in following you. Can we make that our prayer again this morning? Heavenly Father, we humble ourselves again this morning, reminded again by your word of who you are, perhaps, God, in ways greater than we've seen before and certainly in ways greater than we hold on to. This world has a way of stripping it from us, of robbing our attention. God, these weeks in particular, with constant news stories of war and speculation about things to come and fears and anxieties, and God, how real they are. We see in this story the madness and the brokenness of the forces of this world, and we see the storm with its raging wind and waters. But in the midst of them, we are reminded that you are still Lord, that you are king over all these things, and though they may come at one word, they are brought to calm. And so too our hearts and our lives. No matter the chaos or the anxiety or the brokenness, this legion within, that at one word our lives are brought to that same simplicity, humbled before you, sitting at your feet, our eyes fixed on you again. So as we humble ourselves this morning, Lord, I pray you would again give us a sense of your power. God, it's that power we need that sustains us, that power that gives us hope, this rule and reign over all things that we trust today and tomorrow and days to come. So as we worship you again this morning, I pray we would just be reminded of who you are. God, this question that keeps coming up in this Gospel of Luke, that the longer we spend time in this word, the more we see of you in our own hearts and in this world around us. And so again, this morning, by your Spirit, give us a sense of that, this fear of the Lord, this awe of who you are, this sense of your power and majesty and glory and holiness, your rule over all things. God, humble us again before you, that we might come to rest like this disciple, and commission us to go into places and towns and to speak of the things we have seen and experienced, your goodness and your power. So we worship you this morning, Lord. We worship you with that fear in our hearts, not of anxiety, not of dread, but a fear of awe and worship and glory and honor and majesty again, Jesus. It's in your name we pray.